Right now on the phone is a fellow named Sonny Osborne. Hi, Sonny.
Hey, how you doing?
Doing good, man. Doing good. Nice to hear from you. We started out this day with a nice sunny fall day. Now it's a nice gray fall day, but I guess that's what fall is all about. How you doing down there?
Oh, it's about 80, I guess 81 degrees, and it's been sunshine and cloudy all day. So.
Yeah, we're getting the clouds now, which is okay. I mean, what the heck, it's October. We had a great summer, so. Hey, I was thinking about something we could chat about today, and since I've already informed everybody here that I won't be here next Saturday, the show won't happen with me because I'll be down in Nashville, and I thought, heck, we might as well talk about why I'm not going. Huh? What am I coming down here for?
What are you coming in for?
I'm coming down for this thing. It's Sonny Osborne's Banjo Camp.
Really?
Yeah, man. It's next weekend.
Yes, it is.
No. Listen, I know it's not as far for you to drive as it is for me, but I got to plan that stuff out. You just got to drive down the road and show up with your hats and your banjos to sell. I got to get there, man.
When you're retired... You just don't have a schedule anymore. And it's so different. It is so different to not have to do anything anymore. It's not paying for it with my health and all like that, but it is so pleasing just to sit down and think, let's see, what can I do today? I don't think I'll do anything.
Well,
I enjoy it, but yeah, Banjo Camp starts Thursday. I think they're going to have a big thing down at the Station Inn.
Yep.
Where all the players and guests and people like that go down there, and they have a night of just enjoyment. And then we do the Banjo Camp actually starts Friday at about, I think you're supposed to be there at 9 or something like that, and get registered and all that stuff, and show where your rooms are and all that.
Well,
I guess there's stuff goes on Friday afternoon, too.
There is stuff. You're right. It's just all stuff. And even though we have Bill Evans does a good job of writing everything out, it's just all banjo stuff, isn't it, really?
That's all it is. That's what it's supposed to be.
Well, you know, and I first met you, gosh, and it's been, when was the first one? Do you remember 10, 11 years ago? A while ago.
No, I tell you what, it's been 11. This is our 11th or 12th year.
Hmm.
That thing. And that's the first time I met you was the first one.
Yeah. Well, and I remember that first one. And I want you to explain a little bit about how and why you got involved in this. But I remember the first one was Bill Evans was there, Pete Warnick was there, and Ned Lubarecki, I believe, were the guest teachers, and that was also some anniversary of the Grand Ole Opry, and you were still performing regularly with the Osborne Brothers, as I recall.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It was 2001, I don't really know how we got involved in that. Bill and Cindy, my partners right now, and Pete Warnick, and they got me involved in it, and it was just a mass camp, a bluegrass camp, and run by Mass Camp, which is Cindy's company, and she does the country music things, Mass Camp country music, and guitar and all that stuff.
Well, and she does that. She does that all summer, and she's got different versions. And we're talking about Cindy Sinclair, who lives down in Nashville. But she does this Nash Camp program, which is a week-to-week program in the summer. And then, of course, now she travels all over the world producing every kind of a stage event from Country Music Awards. I guess she'll be doing the Oscars next, but she's a busy lady. Well,
she's already done the Oscars. She did them last year.
Did she really? Yeah. Wow.
That was her work to begin with, and she just got into this dance camp thing later on. But no, she produced all kinds of country music shows around here, directed, produced, and she's a smart lady.
Oh, yeah.
And then I think they were going to do a banjo camp, and they got me involved and Peter Horty involved in it. And then, of course, Bill Ned was there. Alan Bundy, I think, was on that first one, maybe two.
He was not on the first one, but he came right after that.
Well, I guess that's right, yeah. But Alan and Tony, I think they were some of the first people that we had. But I know Ned was there, Bill and Pete Warney, and myself at that time. And I was still playing at that time. And, yeah, I was performing on the Opry, and it was the Opry's birthday week. I think it was October, sometime in October. And we had a pretty good time. It was at the Drill Yard House to begin with, which is an interesting story to begin with, because I looked at that place, I took one look at it, I thought, man, I would love to have this place. And so when that lady, the overseer, I thought she was the owner at that time. She was pointed out to me to be the owner. And so I got her off to herself, and I said, you know, what would it take to buy this place? She said, well, look, they were offered $7 million for it. I thought,
wow.
Whoa. That's more than a loaded badger player can afford.
And when you say, you're saying Drouillard with a D, it sounds like Juilliard. That's what I always reminds me of. But it's a mansion down there in just, I guess, a little bit west of Nashville. And beautiful,
yeah,
beautiful place.
55 miles west of Nashville. And, it is just an absolutely beautiful place. It's a huge house. And but I'm kind of glad. I'm kind of glad it was a couple dollars out of my out of my crops race. You know, well, I got to thinking of when she said $7 million, I thought, man, I'd have to work another year or two.
Well, okay.
Isn't that crazy? That's just crazy. But anyway,
well, it's moved around since then, but it's always good accommodations. But here's what I want to ask you about is I remember distinctly, Sonny, that first camp, and you had performed everywhere all over the world in front of every kind of audience. But I'll just tell you this, from now, when I see you now doing this from the first time, being in front of a classroom of people with banjos seemed to be a different environment for you. Am I right?
It's scary.
That's what I thought.
Yeah. The first time that I got up in front of those people down there, I was just nervous, as nervous as I've ever been playing before crowds. And now I played before 105,000 people one time, and 25,000. I mean, I played before presidents, dignitaries of all kinds. And it didn't bother me a bit, you know. They put their shoes on just like I did. But the thing of it is, you're standing there, and off to your right, there's three or four excellent banjo players. And then sitting out there in front of you are people who look up to you and think, this guy is really something. And then you have to perform. And it was really hard for me to do that. Very hard. The only other thing that I can remember, I don't remember what year that 9/11 happened.
I was asked to do
America the Beautiful at the IBMA Awards show. And they didn't want anything else on the stage other than me and the banjo. And so I walk out there, and I rehearsed it in the afternoon, and everything was just fine. Well, I walked out on the stage, and the spotlight, all the lights in the house were off. And then the spotlights, I think there was like three of them, were on directly on me, standing at center stage, up by myself. Well, when you play America the Beautiful, you almost have to have position dots on your neck in order to see where you are in the tune, your hand positions. And those lights hit that thing, and it reflected off that, and it completely blocked it out. And so I had no position dot, and I looked at it, and I didn't realize that till I started to play the tune already. And I got into that, and I thought, oh my goodness, I'm going to have to do this just by feel, because I can't see where I am, because the light's just blinding. And I got really, really, really nervous right then, because the whole IBMA crowd, that auditorium at the Owensboro, was full, and these people, man, I got nervous, because I didn't want to mess up in front of all those people.
Right.
And I mean, everybody there was looking, and America had just been attacked by them goons, in New York and D.C., and everybody was kind of melancholy anyway. I guess that's the right word. And just full of patriotism at that time, and to hear America the Beautiful played, it was really a touching situation. There were people in the audience crying. I mean, really, it was just a really touching situation. I did not want to mess up in front of those people. And I asked for some divine intervention at that time, standing right on the stage. I said, oh, Lord, help me get through this, please. But you know what? I played it without the first vocal notes. And I was so thankful. And after I got done, I said, thank you, Lord. Thank you very much. but I was really nervous that time. But in front of that crowd at the banjo camp, it was very unnerving for me. It was really, and you know what? I saw J.D. Crow get in that same situation in front of that same crowd.
Yes.
And it affected his playing. It affected my playing. I was trying to think if I saw any of the rest of them. Tony, Trishka, no, and Ned, nothing affects Ned.
No, it doesn't.
And Bill Evans is just as solid as can be. Alan Mundy, I think it affected Alan a little bit. But J.D., it really got to him. It really got to him, as it did me. And I can't think of anyone else that it really affected. But to be in front of those people that they're just really looking up to you, and they admire you, or they wouldn't be there. Or it's quite an experience.
Well, I do remember, and I think even at the time you mentioned, because you came in and played that version of America to that crowd there at the banjo camp after you did it at IBMA, probably the following year, I think, is when you came in and played America.
When was 9/11? What year was that?
It was 2001.
2001?
Yeah.
Okay, well, it was that. I tell you, it just had happened. That's right. Because that could happen September the 11th, and our banjo camp was October, and that's when I...
That's right.
I did.
And yeah, because IBMA fell in between there, and we even had, I remember several people that were booked to come that first year canceled because they wouldn't get on a plane.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, we had a small, ambitious crowd.
Yeah, you are right. That 9/11 occurred, and then the IBMA thing happened, and then our banjo camp, or the other way around.
Yeah, right. Right around that same period, right, right.
Yeah, all people right there together,
yeah.
And it was a really touch and go situation. But and I just explained it. I think I said something about that to that people down there at the tool yard that I was really nervous about that.
Oh yeah, so. Oh yeah. Have you ever recorded that? And we started out talking about camp, but have you ever put that America, that version of America the Beautiful, on a record?
Oh yeah, it's on that Civil War thing that we did.
Oh, okay.
I can't think of the title of that.
And if the people listening haven't heard it, it's just Absolutely. I think you told me once that you were at least inspired by the approach that Ray Charles had to the lyrics, I think.
Yeah. He, you know what, he got that. I saw him sing that one time, and he was so into that song that he was sitting at the piano, and his legs were jumping right up and down. I mean, just, he was feeling that so much that his legs, both legs, were just jumping up and down, and I thought, my gosh, that guy is really, really into that song. And I tried to get that same. I think the first time I played that on stage was at Cherokee, North Carolina. And you got to understand this. When I saw Charles do that, I mean, it was like 2 years later. And at every time I picked the banjo up, I would sort of just run over that a little bit. And then when Bobby would be talking at the mic, I'd be standing back there just playing this a little bit, you know. And finally, we got to Cherokee, and there's like 5,000, 6,000 people standing there, over there in that crowd. And so I played America the Beautiful. And I was really intent, and I didn't look at the crowd. I was watching the banjo next to make sure that I got it right, because that it's kind of tough to play, and if you miss a string, if you miss one string in it, it just really messes the whole thing up.
It's really hard. It's really hard to play. Let me just tell you, that is really hard to play. I think I told you once that I practiced and played for a crowd, and I have to sit down to do it because I can't stand up and focus on it. But for people who haven't heard it, it's not a bluegrassy type of version. I mean, it's not Rocky Top through the eyes of America the Beautiful. It's very mellow and melody-based a version, and almost sounds like there are pedals in it with a piano. I guess that's what you heard from Ray Charles.
Yeah, well, and I've heard Little Roy Lewis play America Beautiful, and he plays it fast. But what I do is really slow, just like, kind of like you sang it.
Yeah.
And, speed. And so anyway, I'm at Cherokee, and I start, I told Bobby, I said, I'm going to play America the Beautiful. And he said, okay, go ahead. And so I started playing that, and there's like 5,000, maybe between 5,000 and 6,000 people sitting out there in the audience. And I didn't look at them. I was looking at the banjo neck because I didn't want to miss anything. And I hear this noise, but I didn't know what it was. But I did later, I realized that I heard this rumble sound. And, when I got done with that thing, I mean, it was like the ovation was like a jet plane going over. It was that loud. And I looked up there and everybody in that crowd was standing. That was the noise I heard, was them getting to their feet.
Ooh.
They were all standing. Some of those guys were crying. And I know that sounds really weird when you say that the men was out there crying, but they were. And, so we started to walk off the stage, and there was like six or seven guys up beside the wall as you go off the stage at Cherokee, North Carolina is what it was. And there was like six or seven guys staring out there. One of them was on crutches, one was in a wheelchair, and these guys were veterans from wars that had been shot, wounded, and then they were, this one guy had, I mean, he was really, tears coming out of his, I mean, he was really crying. And he said, I want to thank you for recognizing what this country means to us. And I didn't do it for that. I just didn't do it for that. I just thought it was a beautiful song, and I just wanted to play it. And these guys, man, I'm telling you, but how it affected people was really strange. At Owensboro, that time that I played it by myself on stage, along about the second I played it too twice, and the second time I hear this, and I look out there, and these people are singing along with it. So what I did, mainly, in that second time, too, I played background to them singing it.
Hmm.
It was really, that's a touching situation out there. It really is. And there were very, very few places that it didn't affect that crowd that much. And one of the places was my hometown of Hyden, Kentucky. We did a festival there, like it's called the Osborne Brothers Homecoming Festival. And I played it there, and they didn't act like anything. Just, you know, so what? And then I just, New York City, Boston, I played that thing, and people would rise to their feet, put their hand on their heart, and all like this. Unreal. That reception for that one tune out there was absolutely unreal.
And when you play that on stage, I know you did it alone at IBMA, but when you play it on stage, isn't it basically, is there mostly a banjo solo, or do you have other? I've not seen you do it live except in that one setting down in Nash Camp.
Well, it's just the banjo plays it.
Yeah.
Nobody else takes a break in it,
yeah,
as far as that goes. But the other instruments, and Terry Eldridge plays guitar on that, and he did just a marvelous job, because he played a few runs, and Terry was not a big run playing guy like one of us might say Jimmy Martin, which featured those big heavy runs. Well, Terry didn't do that, but what he did was just very, very, very tasteful, and it really added to America the Beautiful.
Mm.
And but all the guys played along, you know, played just like an instrumental, but they were just very quiet in the background, and it was a very effective tune, very, very effective.
Well, you captured it.
Like I said before, I wanted to get what Ray Charles got out of that, and I can't begin to describe to you how that looked to see him sing that. It was unreal. Absolutely unreal. You know what? I just got to thinking, there is a video of him singing that song in Montreal, I think. It's either Montreal or Toronto. And he did that same thing where his feet were just, he couldn't be still.
Hmm.
It's unreal.
Hmm.
He's a heck of a singer anyway, though, in my mind.
He was amazing, one of a kind. This year, if we get back to, and that's great, I wanted to talk about that America tune, too, because I remember the first banjo camp, and you played it, and it was around that same time period. But I've had the privilege of enjoying the company of, I'm going to try to remember, Sonny, the ones you've already mentioned. Of course, Bill Evans is part of the production with you and puts it together. Ned Lubarecki, who is just an amazing musician of all kinds, and plus being a very funny guy.
A very, very, very funny guy.
He's very funny. Ned's a great guy. I'm just trying to remember back. Alan Mundy, I know, and Alan's coming back this year, I think, right?
Right, yeah.
Tony Trischka's coming back again.
Yeah.
Jimmy Mills has been there. Kristen Scott Benson, Ronnie McCory, Ron Block, Jens Kruger, twice. And Jens came back with the entire band, I think, the second time.
Yeah.
Bill Emerson.
Bill Emerson, I think, coming back next year, too.
Yeah, but I'm just trying to think back through the years of all the great players that you've had, come in there.
J.D.
Crow, yeah, we talked about him. Gosh,
did you mention Mills?
I did mention Jimmy Mills, yes. Yeah. Well, he was a good, he could really get to the bottom of what he was trying to get across, and just a really good guy. I was real happy to see him down there.
Yeah, me too. Jimmy's a good guy. He's a good fella, and really a good player. Kristen, as far as teaching goes, Kristen, to me, if I was sitting in that audience and trying to be taught something, she got their attention. She really got their attention. Kruger is the most masterful sort of executioner, I guess you'd say, a banjo player that I've ever seen in my whole life. But he's the far, he's the far ahead of what my thinking is capable of, that I couldn't understand what he was talking about most of the time. But most people loved it.
Oh, it was, it was really amazing. Just this, like you're saying, this, the stuff he does. And apparently I think from what his own statement is, he plays pretty much every minute he's awake.
Yeah, he does. He really does.
And it shows. And it shows. Yeah.
If I kept thinking of something else, you know, the controversy between melodic a la Bill Keith and that group.
Yeah.
The plates, of what people really like. And what they understand, I should say, I guess, and what they don't understand. There's something to be said for people who can play that way, but when you look at, you know, you think of IBMA, the International Bluegrass Music Association, you think of them as the ultimate pulse, I guess, of bluegrass music, because they understand bluegrass music more than just a normal country music fan. I would think that.
Oh, yeah.
But anyway, and the awards are pretty much in on. They really are. And do you know that in all the time that the award show has been going on, that there's never been a melodic player that won that banjo of the year player?
Well, thinking back, yeah, you're right. You're absolutely right. Of course, you're right. I mean, you know that, or you wouldn't have said it. But I mean, yeah, thinking back, you're right. You're right.
I just got to thinking of that last night. And Kristen has been here to the house, have played the chief banjos and Don Granada and all the other banjos that I had at the time. And she was just leaning to play it like that, and I kept telling her, Kristen, that's not the way that you should be doing that. And, you know, and she's just a young girl at that time, 20 years old. And night before last, I just got to thinking that to prove my point as far as that Bilotti thing goes, I don't know the one. Bill Keith has never won anything. As far as Banjo Player of the Year goes, and nobody, you know, you go up down the list of the ones that have won it, and they've all been straight ahead, hard, driving bluegrass players. Every one of them.
Well, you know, when you say that, I can't even really think of any that have made it to the final round that wouldn't be considered that style.
No, I can't, and you know what, I can't ever remember, Keith, or Kruger. I can't even remember any of those guys ever being nominated.
No, you're right.
Maybe not, huh?
Well, see, that's something you need to bring up this next weekend. You need to, when we get around talking about different kinds of styles, you might want to remind everybody that that
I'm
happens.
I'm going to be just exactly that.
How did I know that was coming?
Oh, yeah. But that proves, it kind of proves the point, I think. Because you hear guys off in the corner doing that stuff, you know. And I'm thinking to myself, what good is that ever going to do you to do that?
Yeah.
You know, I've seen crowds for Earl, Don, JD, myself, me. I don't mean to be bragging, but I have seen this. And more straight-ahead players bring people to their feet at a crowd, you know. You get them playing something, and they stand up. I've never seen it. I've never seen that happen to a melodic player. Not one time.
Mm-hmm.
And even Kruger, when he was at camp down there, I don't think he got stand ovation when he got done.
I don't think we could stand.
I think that, well, as far as Kruger was concerned, they were just dumbfounded.
Oh, no question.
Oh, my God. How can anybody do that? That's what they're all thinking. And I was, too. But
you're right. You're right. A bluegrass crowd, or let's take it out of the situation. Banjo camp's kind of different because you have people that are really focused on banjo playing and maybe not just bluegrass, but you're right. A bluegrass crowd, if you talk about IBMA, Jens is phenomenal, phenomenal musician. But I think you're absolutely right. That's a good point. I never thought about that.
I never thought about it. Not before last. I was thinking about that, and I heard Kristen, some song that she's got on one of her albums. I can't remember. I heard it on the radio, and she was doing some of that melodic stuff, and I got to thinking, you know, I wish she wouldn't do that. And then it hit me that no time had they ever been awarded anything for playing that stuff.
Yeah, you're right. You're right.
You don't hear J.D. playing it. You don't hear me playing it. Earl never played it. Don Reno played it with a flat pick. Just couldn't think, didn't it?
Well, that's something we can talk about down there. That's an interesting... as you're talking, I'm going through my head trying to think, and of course you're right. I mean, you have a memory about this stuff, but you're right. It just doesn't show up at that end of it. That type of playing just doesn't show up in the end results, I guess.
There's something about that doesn't make any sense because everybody just plays like, and I keep going, well, Bill Evans plays that stuff too.
Sure.
He can play that. Trisha, Alan Mundy, people enjoy it, but they sure don't vote for it.
Do you, in mentioning some of that style of playing, do you think, and those names you mentioned, I know, basically mastered or attempted to master, let's say, Scruggs style before they moved on to that stuff. Do you think there are banjo players now that sort of skip those basics and maybe miss all of the roots of all what they need to learn?
Oh, they do for sure. That's a given right there. I know what it takes to learn the right hand the way that it's actually supposed to go for three plays. And if you leave strings out, or leave a string where if you're supposed to hit the third, second, first, and then fifth, first, second, third, if you leave out a second string or a fifth string in that whole thing, you ruined it completely. And people nowadays, other than getting the whole depth of music, of banjo playing, and by depth, what I mean is to listen that closely to it before you can understand that there's seven notes that go through that one lick instead of six or five. But the guys nowadays, they just get the upper crust of it, and as long as they can do that, and you can understand if they're playing Cripple Creek or Cumberland Gap or something, as long as you can they're doing that, well, they're satisfied with that. It's unreal.
Well, let me ask you this then, while you're talking about people learning coming up today, and I think, excuse me, there's probably no doubt we're not going to get into names, but great musicians, but we're talking about great banjo players first. And what would you say to someone who wanted to learn today, had never picked up a banjo, how would you tell them to start learning?
To play the banjo, you mean?
Yes, sir.
Get Scruggs, the album, of Foggy Mountain Banjo came out in 59 or 60, I think. And study that, learn everything about it, because that thing is note for note right. It really is. And learn everything on that. Once you get that mastered, you can do anything with your right hand.
Your suggestion would be pretty much the same thing that you, the way you had to learn, if you're going to start today, you're going to still start with Scruggs, right?
Well, yeah, because he did it right. It's in the very beginning, there's just two of them, it's Earl and Don Reno. And Don Reno didn't have Don Reno played mostly with a forward roll. That means thumb, index, middle, thumb, index, middle. Consistently like that. And for Earl, played thumb, index, middle, and then at times he would go middle index thumb, which is backwards. I'd look at it as backwards. Some people would, but I do. Now, if you play the straight forward roll, your timing won't come out right. Your timing, you'll either wind up a break or an instrumental or whatever you're doing, you wind up 1 beat behind the timing or 1 beat ahead of the timing. And that extra thing that Earl did where he did the backward roll too, that makes the timing come out right. And so, on the basis of that, when I first started playing, that's what I heard, and I heard the difference in the two. I heard that when Don would play a break on something, he would come out one note short or one note over where it should have been. And if you play the exact melody of a tune, exactly word for word like it's sung, you have to use a backward roll in it, or it won't work out right. Or some kind of different roll other than straightforward. And maybe half of a backward roll. I know that some people think, what's he talking about? But unless you do that, you're going to wind up 1 beat ahead or 1 beat behind. And Foggy Mountain Banjo that Earl did, he's got every note and everything is exactly the way it should be sung if you were singing Cripple Creek or Cumberland Gap and, you know, those old tunes like that. Even his tunes, they all worked out good. But in Don's, you listen to most of them and they will be what I'm saying. The timing will not be exactly right. And so that's what I would tell anybody that wants to learn how to play the banjo, or even an experienced banjo player, anybody that wants to learn how to do it right, and get that album and go over it and study it, absolutely study it. And if you need to, slow it down from 33 to 16 on your record player, or if you get one of those Marantz cassette players, you can adjust the speed on those things. And slow it down to where you can hear exactly what they're doing with what he's doing with his right hand. By the time that came out, I had, 59 or 60, whenever that was. I'd been playing, about 10 years. And after, a year or something like that, I realized that this didn't come out right. And that there was something that I was missing. And I finally figured that out. And by the time that came out, I'd already been playing, with the different, roll patterns, for 7 or 8, 9 years, something like that. But right now, if you want to learn it exactly the way it's supposed to be played, you do it that way. And if you do that, if you learn everything he did on that album, that Foggy Mountain Banjo album, if you learn everything that he did and learn it right, don't leave anything out, then from then on, there won't be anything that you can't do with your right hand.
So it's not just that Earl was maybe the first or the most famous first. He was the best at it.
Well, he was first at doing it that way.
Yeah.
Nobody else ever did it that way. And I'll tell you, if you listen to him play, when he first started recording with Bill Monroe, that would be 1945 or 46, he had a little bit of that going. And even those old radio shows from the Opry in the 40s, he had a little bit of that going, but not much. And you could tell as he progressed, by the time that they got, let's say 1948 or 49, by the time, at that time, he had it perfected then. He had that whole thing. So he told me one time, and he was sitting on the back or on the front porch of his house, and I've been there. I've sat right at the same spot. But he was sitting on the front porch of his house. There was always a contest between he and Junie, his brother, on who could play the banjo better, you know. And Earl said that he had been playing Reuben post today, and he said, I come home to something, and he said, I was sitting on that front porch playing. Now, he's just a kid. He's like 7 or 8 years old. And he said, and Judy was walking up the road right over there, and he said, he came up through there, and he said, when he hears me playing, moving, he cocked his head around like that. He said, I figured I had something good right there. And to me, that was either when he learned to split those rolls up to make his timing work out right. And from there, it took him 15, 18 years from then to perfect it.
Wow.
And by the time he got with Monroe, he was still trying to get it perfected because he hadn't been with a good band before. But I mean, you know, when he went with Monroe, you had Bill and Chubby Wise on the fiddle and Lester on the guitar. And I mean, that was serious music right then. And then by 1946, and you can tell the difference. Listen to him play, and you can tell when about the time they got the 10 books of Molly in 46, I think that was, 1946. By the time they got the 10 books of Molly, he had to sound pretty good. And that banjo was really humming. It was sounding real good right there. And then when they left, one of the first things they ever did was Foggy Mountain Breakdown. And by the time he got the Foggy Mountain Breakdown, it was right on it. He was dead on from then on. I mean, and you listen to Earl's Playground and Flint Hill, Foggy Mountain Chimes, all those things, and that's as good as you can play the banjo.
Hmm.
It's just good as you can play it. If you do that, you can do anything from there on. Anything you want with your right hand, it'll do it because you understand what it takes to make it come out right.
Well, let me ask you this. Do you think it's, obviously you're starting with the right hand, getting that right, but and you want to do both of them, but is the strong right hand maybe your best feature of a banjo player? Or I mean, you want to do both, but if you had to pick one.
Oh, it's the right hand. That's the holy grail of banjo playing is the right hand. But if you get the right hand right, correct, then the left hand will have to do what's the right thing. You can't be, because if you got the right hand correct, that left hand's going to follow it. It's that simple.
Well, you know, I did not know that, in your opinion, he was still progressing and still growing until that time period, of the Foggy Mountain Banjo thing. And it's interesting. I've just never heard you even talk about the fact that he was continuing to perfect that whole timing, the whole sequence of the notes and the rolls to fit, within the tune. Wow.
It's kind of interesting,
isn't it? It is, because I always thought of him as being like, you know, once he hit the, of course, what do I know? But once he hit the scene, I thought, well, that was it, and he was considered. But he was well known and playing, but still learning and still progressing.
I don't really remember a time, not one time that I ever picked up the banjo that I just learned something about it, something that I hadn't learned before. I'm talking 50 years of it. More than that, really. I don't ever remember a time that I picked it up that I didn't learn something. And whether it be how far I could kick it, or how heavy it was, or whatever. Whether it be that or like a play, that's two different things. Oh, my God.
Whether you had to shake it hard enough to get the demons out of it?
Oh, yeah. Well, that, you know, there was always, I named him, his name was Krako. K-R-A-K-O.
Wait a minute, spell that again.
Krako, K-R-A-K-O.
Okay,
Krako.
All right.
And I mean, he lived in that banjo, I know he did, because it was, honest to goodness, now you get to thinking about this, sometimes that banjo just absolutely, and I mean, the banjos I had were good banjos. I mean, I'm talking from 1956 to the end of my career. I didn't mess with no toys.
Hmm.
I had good instruments, really, really good, and I kept them up good too. But there was times, even at Granada, the RB3s that Aaron plays right now, original flathead, fine, fine instrument. But at times, you couldn't get one of the tune. And you could tune it perfect with an electronic tuner, and play a half a tune, and it'd be out of tune again. And I blamed it on Craco.
Wait a minute. I got to pull this thread a little bit because you know what I do for a living. But here's my question to you. Did you name him Craco or did he tell you that was his name?
No. I named him that.
Okay.
I named him that. You think this is dumb. Me and that band would sit back there in the back room of that bus and we'd have long discussions about what's wrong with you, why won't you care? And Craco would always do that inner voice that said, you know, as you play a couple of tunes, he could hear you say, not tonight, Kitty, not tonight.
Well, let me ask, okay, now the next question is, did he travel from banjo to banjo?
Oh, yeah. Listen, that thing lives in every one of them. Every one of them.
Well, where is he now? The next question.
He's in Kristen's banjo.
Does she know that?
Yeah. She knows. You ask her next time you see her, hey, well, she'll be there Friday.
That's right, yeah.
You say, hey, who is Craco? She'll tell you who Craco is.
All right, now the next question now is, do you miss him?
Do I miss Craco?
Yeah.
No, absolutely not. Craco calls me more problems than you could ever imagine.
So it's safe to say that talking banjos can be a distraction and create a problem for a musician.
Well, see, nobody could hear it but me.
Okay.
And there were times that I could hear it really, really loud and clear. Not tonight. You might as well quit because you're not going to tune this passion tonight.
Did it happen on stage?
And on stage, even.
No.
I would look over at David Crowe and I'd say, Craco, there's no tuning tonight. And he just shake his head. Unreal. But that's the stupidity of the cook's mind.
Well, did you ever, okay, now, there's lots of movies about this. Did you ever have an exorcism of your banjo?
No. I mean, that's who it was, Craco. That was his name. And he was invisible. And
that's good. I wouldn't want him to be visible. I think if you've got a talking banjo, it's best that the sound comes from an invisible source, don't you think?
Well, no. I don't know what that. And me and Nathaniel have had some amazing conversations over the years, I'm telling you. Amazing conversations.
Do you think you could get your banjo to call in someday?
No, I don't think so.
I'm just kidding. I've heard you talk about him before, but I think it's just an interesting thing that you deal with your instrument in that way, and I've heard you talk about Craco before. I did not know that you had a specific spelling, though.
Oh, yeah. Oh, man. What else can you blame it on? When the banjo, look, if the banjo head is right, not broken, or soft on any spot and that thing, and your strings are good, new, are good, the bridge is right, the nut is right, and, I mean, what else can you blame it on?
I'm with you.
There's got to be a demon in there somewhere, In my case, his name was Craco.
Well, that's the only rational. That's the only rational explanation.
Well, you in your banjo, there's times you can't tune it.
That's true.
And every one of them's like that. Now, Sandy had one in there with his banjo from the 40s, and it stayed there.
His entire career, is that what you're saying?
It stayed there his whole career. Just quit finally. And then it went to that other guy, whatever his name, I can't remember his name. Steve Sparkman. Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. It went to his back too.
Okay.
That's cool.
Well, why don't you make a model, you know, of your banjo that's called Krako? Is that just too much tempt of fate?
Well, I got to think and wonder what he actually looks like. if he would come to life just for a second. People out there right now are thinking, you know, that guy's dumb.
No.
But I got to thinking, what would it look like? Would it be like a gum of some kind, or what would it look like?
Well, what's the answer?
It'd probably be Muslim.
Muslim, okay. All right. All these years, that's been the thing.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, wow.
Good to talk to you.
All right. Well, you heading out on me then?
Yeah, you got 2 minutes.
I got 2 minutes. All right. Well, you're watching the clock on me now. It's all about timing. It's all about timing.
You got four.
All okay.
Right. I'm not done yet.
All right.
I'll tell you what I'll talk about before we leave. Though.
Okay, go.
I'm building a new banjo. It's called the Rocky Top Banjo.
It is?
It's cheap, but it's called the Rocky Top Banjo, and it is an exact replica of the banjo, the RB3 that recorded Rocky Top, that Aaron McDerris has right now and plays for Ron DeVincent.
Really?
And Gil Anderson has one, and Aaron has one. And I've got a new tone range in those banjos that has really made a difference. And I'll have one at Banjo Camp.
Oh, great. I'll be looking forward to seeing it.
Yeah, it'll be good for you to see.
Okay.
It'll be good. All right, that's it.
Well, man, I'll be there. Hey, listen, thanks for calling in, and I'll see you in just a couple of days. I'll be down there sometime Thursday or Friday and hang around for a while. We'll have a good time. It's always a great time. That must be time to leave. Either that's your dog or that's Krako.
Yeah, that's the dog.
Okay.
I'll see you later.
All right, Sonny. Take it easy, friend. Bye.